I'd always enjoyed writing, wasn't really doing much of it in life at that stage, and thought, well, if I can write it down, then my friends and family can read it in their own time. And hopefully when we do meet up next, we can have a bit more of an open conversation. I'll feel more comfortable. They'll feel more comfortable, like they know a little bit, they know a bit more background, and we can start from there.
Welcome back to Not Too Busy to Write. I'm Penny Winsor, author and book coach. Today, I'm in conversation with James Hunt about his debut book, Love Needs No Words, a memoir about fatherhood and caring for his two sons, both of whom are non-speaking and autistic. James began writing online 10 years ago when he found himself unable to say the things out loud that needed to be said. What began as a way to let friends and family into their world has grown into a community of over 400,000 online, in-person events, and a clothing brand aimed at starting conversations. James talks with me about the really difficult decision to have a completely different household setup in order to meet his son's needs. And even though this is a little bit unusual, it has turned out to be one of the best decisions that they've made. James has become an incredible voice, talking openly about men's mental health, particularly around the isolation that caring can bring. His words have reached many who previously felt entirely alone. Love Needs No Words is out now, and if you need to read a story that is filled with hope and also joy about a family that doesn't hit the typical milestones, then this is definitely a book for you. All of the links are in the show notes. Enjoy the episode. James, thank you so much for being with me today.
Thanks for having me, Penny. It's a pleasure.
You have the honour, James, of being the very first man I've had on Not Too Busy to Write.
Really?
Yeah, and it wasn't done on purpose.
Lots of episodes, I never noticed this.
I know, it wasn't done on purpose. It's just sort of happened quite naturally, but I always knew that the first man I had on, I always knew that it would be a carer. So first of all, I would love for you to share with the listeners a little bit about your family and your boys, to kick us off.
Yeah. So I'm a dad of two boys, Jude, who is 17, and Tommy, who is 14, and they are both autistic and non-speaking. Both have ADHD diagnosis, both have learning disabilities. All the diagnoses, we've got them in our house. And yeah, so I have been sharing stories about our lives for about 10 years now online, which sounds scary when I say it like that. They were small little boys when I started, and now they're becoming men. And yeah, we've got quite a unique setup when it comes to my boys. Jude, the eldest, always struggled around other children. So Tommy was a huge trigger for him when he was younger. And what that meant was Tommy would often unwittingly cause Jude to have these big meltdowns just by existing, really, just by being a four-year-old, being loud and unpredictable and being Tommy. And unfortunately for Jude, a lot of his meltdowns would be quite physical and quite intense. And that meant that there were some really, really hard days. And with Jude needing one-to-one care and Tommy really needing one-to-one care, we spent a lot of time when me and their mum were together apart. So one upstairs, one downstairs, one at the park, one at home, doing things we could to try and keep both boys happy. So when we separated, we were left with a bit of a conundrum of how we meet their needs and try and make life better for both of them, because it really, you know, was a struggle at that point. So pretty much for the last 9 or 10 years, they have lived separately. And I have Jude half the week and Tommy the other half of the week, and me and her mum swap back and forth regularly. And it's worked. It was an incredibly hard thing to do at the time. But now it's become our normal and I can't really imagine life being any different.
You and I have known each other for quite a few years. I was trying to think, probably since, like, I don't know, 2018 or 2019 maybe. And I have always been so in awe of how you and Charlotte have managed things with the boys. I also live a slightly unconventional way with my husband and my ex-husband. And it's always just so incredible to be given an insight into families that do things in a way that is just to meet their children's needs and not to kind of live up to expectations that other people have about what a family should look like. And it's felt like such a gift that you've been able to give people to show just a different way for a family to be happy.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm glad we've been able to do that. And that's largely because it's worked out. It's been a huge positive for both Tommy and Jude. It's really made, especially going back like 9, 10 years, it was, you know, the change was instant. Jude was able to have that peaceful home.
Yeah.
And he worried that someone was going to make a loud noise or someone was going to want their TV program on or change the music. And it just has made such a happier life for both of them. And yeah, it's, I guess, one of the benefits of it is we get that reaction. You know, it's... It's very different than you ever imagined life turning out. It's very different than, you know, even families who their parents have separated. It's still a very different setup than what we have. You don't expect to have to split your children up. You don't expect to, you know, because then essentially as well, we are both full-time parents. We've always got one child. And the struggle is we, you know, there's that heartbreaking feeling of not being able to have them both together, not being able to take them both places together or to events and stuff, and which is a struggle anyway because they don't, you know, they're being autistic, is that makes it a struggle for them. So yeah, it's been a very different way of living, but it's one that's worked, and luckily that, you know, for us that means we can look at it positively and it shines across to people like that.
I want to go to the book now and the place that you open with in the book was really interesting to me. I was really excited to read it. You chose to open with the first time you shared any of your writing. I would love to hear a little bit about that and what that was like for you. First of all, writing your experience down for the first time and then sharing it with people for whom you say in the book, up until then, you'd really struggled to verbalize what was happening with your family and what the boys' needs were. And so to write it down and share it instead was scary, but it opened something up between you and the people you knew, and then suddenly with people you didn't know as well.
Yeah, exactly that. The first few posts were purely for family and friends. I found it really difficult to talk about, I guess, the life we were living. We were becoming more isolated. Because Jude was struggling so much with the world, we couldn't go to the family parties. We couldn't go to the weddings, the christenings, the, you know, even just the regular get-togethers or go to the park. Or so I felt like our friends and family weren't getting to know Tommy and Jude. And they also weren't necessarily understanding why we weren't going to these places and what life was like at home. I, as most men do, wasn't, especially back then, wasn't great at talking about my feelings or what was going on. I tended to bottle it up and not really talk to anyone, even my closest mates. And when I did get sort of the rare opportunity to have a bit of free time and my friends would say, "Oh, how are the boys?" I'd say, "Yeah, they're okay, thanks." And gloss over everything. You know, I might say, we're not sleeping too much, or how do you try and explain autism and the fact that they're non-speaking and the meltdowns and, you know, all the different things in 3 minutes in the pub, without feeling like you're massively bringing down the mood of your night out as well, because at the time it was a lot of what was going on in life was the hard things. Now there's a lot more positives I could talk about, a lot more happy moments to share. But I found it really difficult to talk about. So I'd always enjoyed writing, wasn't really doing much of it in life at that stage, and thought, well, if I can write it down, then my friends and family can read it in their own time. And hopefully when we do meet up next, we can have a bit more of an open conversation. I'll feel more comfortable. They'll feel more comfortable, like they know a little bit, they know a bit more background, and we can start from there. What I didn't really appreciate was how the world was going back then, and social media and things being shared, and suddenly friends of friends were reading it, and friends of friends of friends, and it started snowballing, I guess. And suddenly you're getting messages from people in Australia or, you know, in America, and just reflecting that their lives are similar. And that was something I really needed. I think when, especially in the early years, when you're a parent of a child with a disability, you can feel quite isolated and lonely. You feel like you're the only ones. You feel like, you can feel quite lost.
Mm.
And by sharing, it sort of gave me a bit of a community, gave me that sense of there's hundreds and thousands of us all around the world living lives and very different backgrounds and very different experiences, but have a lot in common. And that was really powerful.
Mm. And that community has grown significantly over the years. And is now how big, James?
Hundreds of thousands.
Hundreds of thousands.
Each platform.
Of people all brought together by your two incredible boys, and also your generosity in what you share. And I do think what you share is incredible and incredibly generous. In the book, you write that we don't get handed a rule book when we become parents, but somehow you end up carrying one around inside you anyway. That resonated with me so much. And I think this is one of the tricky things that is difficult to explain to parents who haven't gone through, or to anyone who hasn't gone through, this change in expectations. That often when we become parents, we don't even realize the expectations we do have about our lives consciously, until suddenly our expectations are not met in any way.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about the journey that you went on to kind of come to terms with the fact that you were going to have to throw that kind of, you know, invisible rule book away that we all carry around.
It's a long journey. It takes a lot of time, definitely. It's not a sort of magic one day you adapt and change everything. I think there are huge expectations we have that we don't realize and that we take for granted. Like, I 100% took it for granted that when I had children, they would speak and that they would progress in a, you know, in a pretty typical way, that they would learn to walk and talk at a certain age, that they would make friends, that they'd start school, read, write, you know, go through all those phases. And suddenly when, you know, both my boys were diagnosed before they were two, so it was really, really young, and you get that diagnosis and there's suddenly a lot of fear of, you don't know, obviously, we don't know whether our kids will be, you know, work in Tesco's, be a lawyer, be a doctor, be a footballer, be an actor, be a writer, be all the different things they could be. We don't know that, but we have expectations that they will, you know, walk and talk and make friends and that kind of thing. When that's suddenly taken away, when you're being told that they don't know whether your child will ever speak or whether they'll ever be independent or all of those things at two, it's, you know, it's heartbreaking, and it takes a lot to wrap your head around. Mm-hmm. And then as time plays out and you see your friends and family and their kids progress and go off and do different things, and you feel very left behind because you can't even get to the park, let alone get to the park and have fun and have a picnic, and sit and talk with all the parents, and your day out to the theme park lasts 10 minutes and you don't even, you know, get to enjoy it, all those things suddenly start adding up. And somewhere within it, you have to try and find peace with it, I guess, is the first thing. But also, you start to make adjustments of what works and what doesn't. And that largely comes from your kids. That largely came from Tommy and Jude, and just trusting them in what works and what doesn't. But in the early days, definitely, I did things that I thought they should do. And I thought if we just keep doing it, then they will do it. If we just keep sitting at the dinner table, they will sit at the dinner table and eat. If we just keep going to the park, eventually they're going to like socializing with other people. Because that's what we expect. And that's probably the experiences we had. That might be the experiences that we saw from our own parents, from TV, from books, from films. And we soak it all up without even realizing sometimes. And then it plays out in our own lives. And when that is radically different, it takes a long time to get used to.
Mm-hmm. You write this really beautiful thing, which I love, which is questions that you have for yourself. And, you know, choosing to believe your kids when they're communicating with you, choosing to believe that if they take their coat off, they're fine, that they're not too cold. If they want to put it on, then they're comfortable putting it on. Choosing to trust that when Jude doesn't want to go into a room, there's a good reason for it, even if he can't communicate it to you. This, to me, feels like the kind of crux of what it's like to parent a child that has quite complex needs. This idea that we have to learn to trust our kids more than trust all the people trying to tell us how to be a parent. And it's hard, isn't it? It's a hard thing to learn. It sounds easy saying it out loud, but it's actually quite, it takes a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And part of that is because of what other people think.
Yeah.
And that could be well-intentioned family and friends trying to help and trying to offer advice, but also just general public. And like you said, trusting that Tommy isn't cold and doesn't, we go out in the car now in December and he'll be in a t-shirt and no shoes and socks. And I've got a jacket, a beanie, I'm freezing and he's sitting in the back of the car in t-shirt, tracksuit bottoms and no shoes and socks. And I could try and battle him to get clothes on each time we go out and cause him a lot of distress and put him on edge. And then you realize, well, who are you doing that for? If he was cold, like really cold, he would want a blanket. He would want a coat. He would, at some point you have to learn to trust in that. Obviously when they're younger, you feel like they don't necessarily know. When, you know, if it's a 3-year-old, you feel like, well, no, you have to wear these clothes. But at some point, yeah, you have to realize that the adaptations you're making should be for them, not for anybody else. And it can take time to get to that stage.
Yeah. You say, which I really love, you ask yourself, and I do this exact thing as well, am I parenting for other people or am I parenting for my child? And I think that's such an important question, I think, for all of us to ask ourselves when we're making choices as parents, no matter who our kids are.
Yeah, because I think that could be for, you're right, for all parents, for whether we're trying to push our kids to go to university or we're trying to, you know, make them continue with that hobby that they started that they don't even enjoy anymore, or, you know, make them go to the birthday party that they are going to have a meltdown at and really struggle with being there because they're 5 and they should enjoy birthday parties. That's something a 5-year-old should do. And yeah, that is, when you get to that stage, it's like a huge weight comes off.
Yeah.
Because now it's tricky because sometimes you feel like, why am I not pushing my kid enough? Because obviously we want them to thrive and to grow and to reach their full potential that they, you know, that they can reach, and be that in experiences or learning. Or and sometimes I do have to think, well, do I take the safe and easy option, or do I try and step outside their comfort zone a little bit? Their mum is very good at pushing them outside their comfort zone, and I'm very good at, no, let's keep things, stick to their routines and keep it happy and protect them. And I guess between us, there's a mix of, I hope we're getting it right, that we're, you know, for instance, we were just talking before this, last week Jude went to a club night, which was a club night for young adults with learning disabilities, and he's in this busy nightclub with music pumping, lots of people his age or a little bit older, and having a time of his life. Now, that is the same boy who couldn't be in the same room as his brother when he was younger, or any other kids. He really struggled at school, really struggled being around kids and noise. But now as an adult or a young adult, he's comfortable with his peers, and he's comfortable. He'd hate to be around a 5-year-old, but around another 17, 18-year-old who is, you know, on his level and in the right situation, he can have the best time. And, you know, Tommy's been abroad a couple of times recently, and the first thing that comes to my mind is, oh my God, what if the plane's delayed? What if we're stuck at the airport and he has a meltdown in this busy airport? But he's done it and he's handled it and loved it. And it's, I guess it's learning where to push and what, you know, what the benefit is. And are we doing it for other people or are we doing it for them?
That's really well put. It's something I constantly struggle with. So I totally feel you. You write in the book as well about your experiences with schools, and and you write very honestly about your first impression of both going to visit a mainstream school before Jude was ready to start school and also going to see a specialist school. And knowing that the mainstream school felt just like it was not going to work, but also you were really honest about how you felt very mixed about the first time you went into a special school. And I wanted to ask you about that because, I mean, especially at the moment, there's so much in the media about SEND and about special education. And I think we're not really honest enough about the kind of baggage that we as parents bring with us about what we think special education looks like and what it is. And it's actually often very different than we expect. I was really terrified about special education. I couldn't imagine it would be better than mainstream. And it is literally the best decision I have made in my son's entire life because we have generally had a very good experience with it. That first time you went to see what became Jude's school and then eventually Tommy's school, talk me through what that felt like and how things changed for you.
Sure. So I think the first time, you're right, when the first time you go to a SEND school, it brings up a lot of emotions. And firstly, it's a very emotional time anyway, because you're new to this whole world. You're new to, you know, right? We certainly were. Still learning so much about autism, what it meant for Jude's future. And then you're suddenly, within a year, trying to pick out a school for him, for potentially for the whole of his education. And you're trying to imagine, well, our 3-year-old, what will work for him? And it's not as simple as when you go to the local mainstream and you look at results and you look at, is there anyone you know who goes there already and how are they getting on? Our path is very different. When we went to look at mainstream, it instantly felt wrong for Jude, partly because, I mean, I'd imagine it's quite different now, but back then, a couple of schools we went to, they were like, oh, we've had one kid with autism before. You're like, really? One in,
they would have had more, but they didn't realize it.
of course, which I don't think any school would say now as a mainstream. But back then, that is, you know, we're going back 14 years-ish, that was what a couple of schools had said. So that obviously made us feel quite uncomfortable that, oh, they're not going to know how best to help Jude. Then you go into a SEND school, and I think the first thing that's overwhelming is the fact that we hadn't really met any other kids who were autistic or had a learning disability before. And suddenly you're seeing 100 of them. Mm-hmm. And you're seeing, certainly at the schools we went to, you're seeing 16-year-olds and 4-year-olds and 12-year-olds. And you're so caught up in, or I was so caught up in, who is Jude like? Who's doing similar behaviors to Jude? Whose personality seems like Jude? And then looking at the older kids and thinking, oh, is that Jude when he's 12? Or is that Jude when he's 12? And so there's all those things going on in your mind, along with trying to pick where the right place is for your child. And yes, suddenly seeing 15-year-olds who are non-speaking, and that fear kicking in of, oh my God, maybe Jude will be 15 and non-speaking. And now it's totally different. Obviously, I've been in this world for you know, 15 years and met so many amazing kids and so many amazing adults, and feel very comfortable in those spaces. But back then, definitely, I wanted to cry. I wanted to run out and feel like this isn't our future. This isn't what life's going to be like for Jude. But at the same time, we also found, so we went to see a different SEND school first, which we felt wasn't quite right. And then the second visit was the SEND school that we chose. And yeah, just fell in love within minutes of being there. Just the way the teachers were interacting with the kids, the way they knew everyone's names, the way they seemed to know what they all needed. Mm-hmm. And it felt, in a way, it felt very much like a primary school that I would have gone to in a strange way of describing it. It just felt very, when you send your kid into school and they're non-speaking and they're, you know, have a lot high support needs, you have to have a huge amount of trust in the people who are looking after them, which you do to an extent in any school, but you need, you know, it's even higher. And we wanted to send him somewhere where we felt like they'd love him and care for him and you know, really nourish him. And that, we got that impression straight away. Mm. And that we got the, and it's something that would never happen today. They told us, we want Jude to come here.
Mm.
And when we were leaving, they were pretty much convincing us to apply to their school. And sadly, they can't do that anymore because there's not enough spaces, or there's not enough. They know it's a 2-year wait, and they know, I've heard of schools pretty much telling people not to apply, even though it would be right for their needs. And we were lucky in that sense that that was our experience. And when we came to look at it for Tommy as well, they couldn't wait to meet Jude's little brother.
Mm.
They really wanted Jude's little brother to come to that school. So yeah, it was a lot of mixed emotions at the time, but yeah, they made us feel like we were making the right choice.
Mm. Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? Because I think that also because, and this is, you know, the media is a lot responsible for this, there is such a huge emphasis on inclusion as being the gold standard of being, we must make it possible so that schools are inclusive, so every child can go to their local school. And when that conversation is happening, it's ignoring the fact that those environments, even if those environments are adapted and even if they have all the funding in the world, they're not actually the right environments for some of our kids. And that is not necessarily a bad thing. Like, it's okay for some kids to just need something different, and it's not bad. And actually, I had a similar experience with my son's primary school, his SEND primary school. that it was just, they just adored him. They adored him, and he had the most incredible education. And I, in fact, liked that school better than my other child's mainstream school, which was also a very good school. But like, just the dedication of the staff, the kind of, you know, the community that they created, it's just, it was special. It was really, really special. And I've always thought, you know, it's so important for people like us to talk about that, right? Because I don't think we should be afraid of special education. Like, I just think, I mean, it could definitely do with a different name, quite frankly. But like, there's no need to be scared of it, because it can actually be an incredible gift for our kids.
Yeah. And it's something I see a lot of now from, you know, families I meet and talk to. I see lots of kids like Jude and Tommy who go to mainstream, and mainstream are doing their best to, like you said, make it as inclusive as possible. And our local primary school has become very good at that. But what seems to happen is it works for 2 or 3 years.
Mm.
And the gap continues to spread. And then there's a bottleneck of these kids who probably should have gone to a send school to begin with, but either there wasn't this place, or it was thought that mainstream would be the better option for them. Then they get to like 8 years old, and suddenly mainstream isn't working.
Mm.
And there's no space in the send schools, and they either end up out of school or in a year or two of stuck in limbo and waiting.
Mm.
And yeah, I mean, it's as you said, it's in the media a lot at the moment. It's a huge, huge problem. Pretty much every family I talk to of a child between 5 and 8 is, they feel like they're in the wrong school.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have a school place, or that like EHCPs aren't being met. And it's just the same story over and over and over and over and over, which is heartbreaking. Because, and I have to catch myself, because I find myself saying we're lucky, but we're not lucky.
Mm.
We've got what Jude and Tommy are entitled to, and what every other child is entitled to. We didn't have to go through a huge fight to get it, but that doesn't mean we're lucky. It means, you know, we've got what we should have, and what all these other families should have as well. I just feel lucky in comparison to, I know now if Jude was 4, the likelihood is we'd have a huge fight on our hands.
Yeah, I know. I agree. It's a really, really tricky thing to use the word lucky, because to use the word lucky takes away from the fact that there is a system responsible for the fact that some children are not having their educational needs met, and all children deserve to. Yeah, it's deeply frustrating, deeply, deeply frustrating. I think I am one of only a few people I know in my area of a big number that didn't have to go to tribunal for their education. Yeah. So I have also put myself in that lucky camp many times. And the idea that we can call ourselves lucky because we didn't go to court for our child's schooling is like insane, isn't it? It's insane. Yeah. Let's move on to something a little bit more.
Yeah.
Lighter than that. I want to hear about what it's been like for you writing in a space as a man that is often very dominated by women, writing about caring, writing about parenting. What has it been like for you to create a space that for men to be able to talk about their experiences raising disabled children? And what has that sort of opened up? I want to hear a little bit about that side of it.
I guess it's made my account quite unique from the beginning, which has definitely helped with the growth of it. Because, you know, as you said, there is a space that is quite dominated by women, by mums. So I guess it's maybe more memorable in that sense. Although I used to get a lot of comments. Nowadays, obviously, you have a lot more videos and stuff with, or you have audio of me talking. And I used to, or if I posted a picture of Jude or Tommy that went well, and I'd written everything, I used to get so many comments saying like, "Well done, Mum!" Like really, always assuming that I'm a mum talking about this stuff. So yeah, that doesn't happen quite as much now, but it used to happen all the time. It's good. It's funny, I was talking about this last week, that I still feel it's massively underrepresented. I feel that even when I look at statistics of my followers, it's like 85 to 90% female, which is disappointing, I guess, in a way that I'd hope that my account would reach more men. And that more men would be interested in following. I'd always get a lot of messages from women saying how they share my posts with their husbands, or they tell their husbands about stuff. And then I think, why don't they follow? Why don't they?
Yeah.
So it's, yeah. And then obviously people, you know, it's your social media, you can follow whoever you like. It's just, yeah, interesting that clearly men generally stick to, I guess, topics they're just more interested in than, you know, in hobbies and pastimes and like, rather than parenting. So yeah, I've met a lot, you know, I've definitely spoken to a lot of dads over the years and had, you know, it has become a bit more of a safe space for them to message me or something, but definitely I'd love those numbers to be a bit more equal, move towards being more equal anyway. And I'd say, I mean, I mentioned it in the book as well. I know that people talk about me very positively compared to how they talk about women in this space and how they talk about mums. I know that I have to do, you know, the basics, and I get called a great dad, and I get called, you know, I get lots of praise, and I see a lot of the abuse that women get online and that mums get online for sharing their story in a very similar way to me, and lots of things that get said that people never say to me. And sometimes that's in real life as well. I've felt that with Jude and Tommy when I've been out. I've definitely never had as much judgment or snarky comments that you get in public compared to mums. I know Charlotte's definitely had more like tuts and eye rolls and you know, whispers and stuff like that. And if Tommy's been struggling in the supermarket than I've ever had. So that's interesting as well. Like I do feel there's a lot of work to do on that. Obviously I like the praise.
Well, I mean, let's be clear, you're not doing the bare minimum, James.
No.
I mean, that it's so interesting to me that you've seen that clearly compared to other women in a similar space to you writing online. I would be really interested to talk to you again when the book is out and it's been out in the world for a little while about whether, because I wonder if, you know, reading a book can be a very private experience in a way that might be, that I think is really great for this topic. And I wonder if the book might reach more men than in some ways in the social media, and that, you know, that in that way that we can kind of have a book in a really private moment, that no one else will kind of really know what we're consuming in some ways. I really hope this book reaches lots of men, because I think one of the things that you do really beautifully, as well as kind of talking about your boys and your incredible relationship with them, is, you know, you're very open about your mental health, both online and in the book, in a way that I think is so refreshing, and we need so much in the world, and there's so little permission, you know, societal permission for men to be open about what they're struggling with. And so I really hope that this book reaches the men that it needs to, because we all know how challenging as much as we adore our families, and as much as there's so much joy and pleasure in our incredible boys, there's so much that's so difficult and so isolating.
Yeah. Yeah, I hope so too. I only have to look at my own circles and you know, men that I know, that parenting is hard. Being an adult is hard. The responsibilities of work and family and everything, relationships, it, you know, even with all the best circumstances in the world, it can be very difficult and be challenging mentally. So when you do add in sort of high support needs and lack of sleep and, you know, financial stresses because of work and trying to juggle everything, then yeah, it's definitely impacted my mental health over the years. And it's something that you have to continue working at, because some of the things we've already spoken about that adapting to a different life, there's still days where it hits you and comes back, and there might be a new phase. There might be a new, like Jude's going to be 18 this year, and his life is going to be very, very different to a typical 18-year-old, or to what my life was like as an 18-year-old and what I expected his life to be like. He's going to leave school next year. There's that phase. There's, Tommy would be doing his GCSEs next year, but he's not going to be. So there's always these little phases and new things that come up. I found that they impact you less over the years, or maybe I've learned ways to cope with it and how to handle it as well, and what I need to do in those moments. But yeah, I think it's a continual work in progress, I guess, which I think once we realize that is really important. Once we know that, life just isn't going to be good and happy all day, every day. It just doesn't work like that. And there are going to be phases and times where life gets hard. Definitely it has, again, in the last few years for other reasons. But I think our experiences mean that we learn how to cope with it. When I was dealing with Jude and Tommy's early diagnosis, I had no experience. I had very little experience of being a dad, let alone being a dad to an autistic child who may never speak. So how I dealt with things and handled things then is very differently to how I am now, as, you know, 17 years in. All of us as parents, that's true of. Like, we, you know, we're all doing it for the first time. We're all, I don't think I necessarily appreciated that when they were much younger. I felt like, I should be a good dad. I should understand. I should be a know-it-all and do it all. And lots of parents do that. But yeah, we're all figuring it out as we go.
Mm. I want to ask you about the writing now, because I feel like if anyone could claim that they are too busy to write, it would be you, James. And when people ask me about how I manage to write amongst, you know, responsibilities, for me, it's really a clear answer. And that is that I think sometimes people assume that writing only takes from me, like it takes away something, it takes away my time. But for me, I see it the opposite. It gives me something. And that's the reason I make time for it, is because I get so much back from it. And I want to hear from you, what is it that helps you sit down and write amongst all of the other things that you could be doing with your life?
I think so. I started really writing the first draft in January last year. So I signed the book deal in November, I think it was, the year before. Had obviously an outline, had some draft chapters, but sat down fully to write, get Christmas out of the way, boys go back to school, this is it. And it was really tough. I thought it was going to be a lot easier. I won't lie. I thought that, you know, I'll block out this time every morning and I'll sit there and write, and I'll just gradually work through the chapters, and I've got plenty of time to fit it all in. And yeah, it was really, really tricky. I think partly because of the topics and having to put myself back into some hard times, I guess, and really almost relive it, because you're trying to remember how you felt, remember, maybe describe a certain scene. And at times that became quite heavy. So I really wasn't looking forward to writing. Not, I thought I'd be like struggling. If it was a struggle to write, it would be, you know, writer's block, can't get the words out, can't. But it was more emotionally, to be honest. It was it became like I've got to go and sit and write.
Put myself back there.
Exactly, yeah. I didn't finish it yesterday. I've got to go and do it again. So that was hard. I tried my best to be like, right, I'm going to block out 2-3 hours a day and I'm right. And sometimes that worked and sometimes it didn't. And sometimes it was 20 minutes at 11 o'clock at night. And I guess I was so used to writing online every day, posting every day.
Mm.
And sort of carving out a bit of time for that. And then suddenly you're trying to find hours to write much longer. That was strange getting used to. But yeah, it was a process. It was definitely a process of, I'd love to say I sat down, it was all idyllic and, you know, really, and I definitely, you know, don't get me wrong, there's parts of it I definitely enjoyed it, but it was, yeah, there was some days it was a real struggle. And I've definitely heard writers on here talk before about, you know, just getting the words down and, you know, just don't edit until you know, just keep writing. And I struggled with that, but I've had that voice in my head telling me, no, keep writing. And yeah, and then you have the whole, well, this is just awful. This is the worst words ever written by anybody. You need to scrap it all and start again. So that, yeah, that lovely voice in your head was a battle each day. until pretty much the end of the first draft, which was May.
Yeah. And so you've written online for many, many years.
Mm.
This presumably then was pretty much your first time working with an editor, then I'm guessing. I'd love to hear about how that experience was of handing over your words to someone else and talking about it and getting feedback and all that kind of stuff. How was that process? Did you enjoy it? Did you find it hard?
I couldn't wait. Couldn't wait for someone else to read it and tell me, firstly, was it any good? I think, because the other thing with writing online every day is you get feedback.
Yeah.
You get instant feedback. Mm. And it's taking you 2 minutes to write it or 20 minutes, but you get instant feedback and that makes you feel a little bit better about yourself. Whether it's one comment or 100 or one like or 100, you're getting some kind of validation at the end of the day and it's finished. So when I think I handed over a couple of early chapters just to see I was on the right track of what they was expecting and so on, and then I don't think I handed over anything more until the whole first draft was done.
Mm.
So for months it was just me and in my own head of like, how do I try and, you know, finish this chapter? When do I think? I think that's the difference as well. So used to writing into an Instagram caption of words, and then suddenly you've got to write a 5,000 word chapter and trying to figure out when do I end it? Where, you know, what's a good point to end the chapter? How do you end the chapter?
Yeah.
It's the beginning, middle, and end. So that was all quite new. But yeah, I couldn't wait for someone to read it and provide some feedback and construct it. You know, I was like, just tell me, just like, I don't care if you want to rip it apart and move everything around. Like, I just want someone who knows what they're doing to have a read through. And luckily there wasn't lots and lots of changes to make at each stage. It was, you know, some of it was about structure, and I'd say from the first draft it was about structure and what stories fit in what chapter and order to do things in and moving bits around. Then I think there was probably four edits in total, four or five edits. And then obviously it becomes much more detailed and, you know, line by line going through and changing things. But yeah, I really wanted someone who knew what they were doing to and make it better.
And how does it feel now? Because you've got, this is like, you know, it's such a different thing, isn't it, to kind of writing, sending it out online every day, and you get feedback and responses and all those lovely things, but it's almost like it's out and it's kind of gone. And now you have this physical thing that you can hold in your hands and keep forever. Does it feel worth it now, all that hard work to like have it all in one place, to have this kind of, I guess, like a legacy for the boys as well in many ways?
Yeah, there is that. And I think in the last few weeks, been thinking about that. And it's strange when suddenly it's like, okay, well, that's it. It's done now. There are no more edits. It is going to print. You can't touch it anymore.
Yeah.
Okay. And then you've got that waiting period of, you know, weeks for it to, you know, arrive and be in your hands. And now it's it's the other side of it. It's the, will people like it?
Mm-hmm.
And that's there's not many people who've read it so far. You know, as we record this, we're like a couple of weeks away from it coming out. So yeah, it's the other side of it. It's that,
yeah.
You know, how's it going to be received? Will it reach the right people? But yeah, it's exciting and terrifying. And yeah, it's obviously, if an Instagram post doesn't go well, it's over. You write the next one the next day. But this is a whole, you know, 18 months of work and a full book. So yeah, a lot more on the line.
I want to just quickly ask as well, you have fairly recently started a new business as well, a clothing line. Mm. Tell us a little bit about that, and also how that is now fitting in the business you're running with caring for the boys, writing for your community and keeping all that. How is all of that going together?
Well, it all links together. That's the beauty of it. So started SAA Clothing a couple of years ago. So SAA, always got stories about autism. That's the name of my page. With the idea being that I wanted to create something that could bring people together. And so all of our designs are sort of positive messaging around inclusion, around autism, around neurodiversity. And I wanted it to be done in a way that people want to wear our clothes, that they like them and that they're happy, you know, they want to wear them to the pub, to the gym, to the school gates, to, you know, the park. And had a dream of, as it grows, it kind of being an icebreaker for people. So we're at a great stage now where, because we've been going so long and things are going well, like people are seeing people on holiday wearing them and starting a conversation. They're seeing a mum at the school gates and feeling comfortable to go and talk to them about their own kid. Because, you know, me and you have definitely been there. We've been at the park and we've seen families and been like, is their kid autistic? Like, they look like they might be. Do I go and like try and say hello? Do I, you know, is it awkward if they're not? Or they don't know that they're autistic? So we wanted it to be an icebreaker and to sort of start a community. I always say that it's like when I go back to London when Arsenal are playing, and you walk around and there's thousands of people wearing Arsenal shirts, and you feel, even though you don't know those people, you feel connected. You feel like you're part of a community. And that is what we've tried to do with SAA Clothing. It's largely online, but we have a shop in my hometown. We get lots of families come in and visit us. They come and they want to have a chat. We've got a sensory room in the shop so kids can hang out and make that whole shopping experience a bit easier. When families come, like it was half term last week, we have families in there for like 2 hours, 3 hours, and their mums and dads are chatting, their kids hanging out. Everyone who works there is either a carer themselves or they're neurodivergent. So they've got a lot of lived experiences that they can share with people. And it's become a really buzzing community that, you know, it's a joy to be a part of every day. We've recently added SAA books. So we are now selling books in the shop as well, all about autism and neurodiversity. Your book is in there, Penny. So you are now in our shop. We also last year started something called SendFest, where we, so through, again, through this community, we've realized that we're always looking at what's missing, what will help our families. And so we approached a couple of venues last year, and too often places do, they'll do an autism hour, or they'll do, you know, trampolining at 9 until 10 on a Sunday. And that's great for some, but not for everyone. So what we have started doing is we have hired the venue for the whole day, and we take it over, and it's just for our families. It's just for send families, but that also means siblings as well. So they get to come and enjoy, you know, everything that we do. We had it at Marsh Farm last year. We've got more this year. We've got a night at Colchester Zoo coming up. So places that families can get together. And the beauty of it is they can relax. They feel that there's no, they're not worried about their kids stimming. They're not worried about how much noise they're going to make, or if they're flapping their hands, or if they're hopping, and or they're struggling to cue. Like, all that pressure is taken away. And there's also, you know, you look around and parents are talking to each other. They're getting to know each other. And we've had people come. We did one in the summer holidays last year. And they're like, this is our only day out in the 6 weeks that we've managed. Like, this is the only place we've been able to go, because they just knew that they could come and relax. And and that's been amazing. And we've got lots more of those events coming up this year. And that, again, it all goes hand in hand from initially sharing stories about Jude and Tommy online, and people, and it resonating with people and them connecting to them, then wanting to buy the clothes and support and get to know the community even more, to then coming along to the events. So yeah, it all goes hand in hand, and it's really, you know, it's lovely. It makes working fun.
Oh, that is just incredible. And I'm going to put all of the links to all of that in the show notes. So go along and discover more. How exciting that you're selling books there now. Brilliant.
Yeah.
You'll be able to have your own book in there. How amazing. James, thank you so much for having this conversation with me today and for giving me some of your very precious time. It's just an incredible book. I hope it gets into every single hand of people who need it. There's so many people who need it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been great.